he my prince? Is he the toad? Waiting, wondering, is getting too old. I'm gonna let down my hair, slide up my skirt, get me out and be the biggest little flirt. Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone. This is your host, Veronica Monet. It's another Monday, and my guest tonight is Eric Johnson from Seattle. He's actually a good friend of mine, and he's got a bunch of questions for me. I think he's going to probably put me through the ringer. He also might catch us up a little bit about what's going on in Seattle. I'm actually headed up there in about 2 weeks. Eric, welcome to the Shame-Free Zone.
Thank you, Veronica.
It's good to have you here. And so, first of all, can we just get a weather report for Seattle?
It's
been
just
nice
started
up there.
Raining. Apparently
no.
It's going to be cloudy.
No, don't tell me that.
Well, you're not here yet, friend.
I'll leave a summer for more winter. Ah.
I think Friday it's going to clear up, so there
yeah.
you have it.
Yeah, okay. And how are the horses?
They're just great.
Yeah?
They're
chomping their hay down.
Do you
want to use this time to get a little shameless self-promotion?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, fine. Well, anyway, so I understand you've got some questions. You're going to put me on the spot tonight, and I'm all ears.
All right, Veronica.
Well, hopefully
I have some answers,
too. Go for it.
Well, answers. You always have answers. I'm just going to pull stuff out of my life and hit you with them and see what happens.
Okay. Sounds like fun.
Right now, I'm afraid to enter into a relationship. I mean, I'll just be honest. And I think my tendency in the past has been to abandon myself. You know, it's true love. You put the other's good ahead of your own, and you make the sacrifices to make it work for them.
Yeah.
And that hasn't been working so well.
That doesn't work very well for any of us.
The other people always start taking advantage. I don't understand.
What is that?
Yeah.
And so, yes, they do.
So boundaries. You know, you've taught some about boundaries, and I've learned here and there that, you know, you have to stand up for yourself. How do you do that dance? A boundary feels so rejecting. Yeah, that's nice, dear, but no, you can't have it.
It really is. Was the word you used dance? How do you do that dance?
Dance, yeah.
Yeah, because it is. It is a dance, and it's not real cut and dried and I don't think there's like a set of rules where you can say, I will always do this, and then I will never be in trouble.
Right.
It takes more of a subtle navigation through your life using your intuition, and you really have to be in touch with your emotions. Of course, emotions are a little confusing because sometimes they bring up issues from our past, you know, something that we oftentimes call triggers, meaning that we have kind of some buried charges, emotional charges, that get activated by situations that are happening right now today, but oftentimes have more emotional content than the situation in front of us really warrants. So that's a little minefield that can really confuse one. You can start to wonder, Am I getting my needs met in this relationship, or am I just getting triggered into my past? Is this an opportunity for healing? Maybe I need to practice a little letting go and just walk through it And other times, you know, it's a distinct message that you are in some territory that's not really working for you and might actually be self-destructive. So some of those things tend to feel very similar. And I think that's where a lot of us get confused. They have a saying in 12-step recovery, you know, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And
right.
Almost everybody always says, yeah, that wisdom to know the difference, that's the real quencher there.
Looking back, what do we call it? Hindsight. Hindsight.
Or Monday night quarterbacking. Yeah, that we're always experts in the things we've already done. But when you're going through it, there is a lot of, you know, you're doing the best that you can. You certainly can learn from past situations. But there's a certain amount of risk. Relationships do incur risk. And a risk on a lot of levels. You know, you risk getting your heart broken. You risk being betrayed or lied to. You risk abandoning yourself. You risk everything being absolutely perfect and then, you know, the person dies or something. So, one way or another.
Ouch.
And it's true, though.
Yes.
You know. Some of my best relationships have actually been with dogs, and that is the one annoying thing about dogs. They do die.
quickly, yes.
So regardless of how perfect the connection is, you are risking a certain amount of pain. So I think that's one of the first requisites, actually, for being in a relationship is, are you willing to show up for a certain amount of discomfort? And loss, because that is going to happen. Of course, the what you get out of being connected is amazing. And there's been a lot of studies that have proven that people who are in long-term committed relationships actually live longer, healthier lives.
Is this an advertisement?
Yes. So, although you may get your heart broken, you could live longer.
Well, these things happen. Well, so suppose you do get in a scrum with your beloved, and stuff's going back and forth, maybe accusations, and so there you are. You're thinking, this sounds so familiar. Am I just triggered on past stuff? Is she doing a number on me?
Yeah.
What's going on? How do you unconfuse that? Is there a way? I mean,
I found for myself that it's usually a combination of factors. I am usually triggered into something from my past, and oftentimes there's also something happening right now in front of me that's unacceptable. So, you know, it's good to employ something I call a timeout, which is simply to just separate yourself from the situation and from your loved one long enough to try to get some perspective. And then come
back
away to
say,
huh?
Give me 20 minutes, see you tomorrow.
I'm taking a timeout.
Wow.
I need a timeout. This works great if you and your partner actually have an agreement about what a timeout is and how long one lasts for. But this is where a lot of people fail to have an agreement. So if one person is familiar with the term timeout and the other one's not, it doesn't mean a lot to your partner. In my marriage, you know, when I was married, we had, and actually I'm still very good friends with my ex-husband, so we do take timeouts even today. We've been divorced for 7 years and we're still working on the relationship.
Well, that's something.
I'm sure a lot of people would think we were crazy. I mean, you know, at least you'd be married and have some benefits for all that hard work, but for some reason, we've decided to continue to work. So we are. And we have agreements that have been in place for, you know, a good 15 years or maybe longer. And our agreement about a timeout is that it means once a timeout is called, we stop talking to each other because the other person is announcing that they're either triggered or too emotional to really be any good to the conversation. So the first rule for us is, you know, you stop. You just stop talking. It's like, okay, you called the timeout. It's like you were on the football field, you know. You don't
right.
say, okay, I'll honor the timeout right after I throw this football.
Right. Just one more play.
Timeout is a timeout. Interrupt the play. The
okay,
other,
Then you use the time to try to unscramble yourself.
Well, just going back to the agreement about what a timeout is, you know, our timeouts are never to exceed 24 hours. Whoever calls the timeout is obligated to reconnect and also to let the other party know when they're available to follow up on that particular conversation or crisis or conflict. So you can come off of a timeout and say, I'm not ready to discuss the thing that we were having problems with, but I just, you know, wanted to reconnect so that we can do the other business of living. But
okay, so that you're still with them.
Yeah. Yeah, and the 24-hour thing is so that you don't call missing persons. So there's some practical stuff built into this, too. But, yeah, so when you take a timeout, the first thing really is to do something nice for yourself, and this is where I really have a hard time with that one. I always forget. I go straight for the work. It's like, okay, now I'm going to try to figure out what went wrong, what's going on, how I'm feeling, what I need, what I don't need. And I often forget to reward myself for taking a time out because the idea is you're supposed to say, you know, good for you that you didn't stay engaged and then say something that you might regret. So if you can do something nice for yourself, it becomes a positive reinforcement to take time outs again.
Wow. So I suppose that helps pull you out of the triggering as well.
It helps. It helps a lot because you get some perspective. A lot of times, you know, if you are able to be introspective and ask yourself a few questions, which is often, you know, what my partner and I both do, we ask each other, ask ourselves questions, not each other, and we find out, sure enough, something's getting triggered from our childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, but that's sometimes that is just part of the issue. The other issue will be, yes, you know, this thing reminds me of my mom or dad or something that happened to me when I was a kid, and I also don't like it when you do it.
Right, exactly. You know? It's not like it's totally divorced from the present.
No, it, the more history you have with a partner, the more some of those triggers will actually apply to the relationship and have nothing to do with your childhood. It'll be all about the history that you have with that person.
Yeah, you have your own set of triggers.
Oh, God, yeah. You know, I know with my ex, a lot of times it'd be, you know, somebody else said this or did this, that'd be one thing, but you did something in 1989,
mm-hmm.
which I've never forgotten. And, you know, that's the thing about triggers. It's not a resentment. It's not an active, intentional, you know, staying stuck in the past. It's really like this reflex that oftentimes we don't have much control over. So taking a time out gives you a way to put a container on it so that you do as little damage as possible.
You know, a funny thing happened to me this weekend. Driving down the freeway, came to an interchange, and I said to the person next to me, this is where that guy cut in front of me, and I almost killed us all. And I realized that every time I go through that interchange, just out of the blue, I realize this is the place that guy cut me off and almost killed us all.
Wow.
It's a reflex, like you say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent work, Eric, because, you know, a lot of people suffer from road rage. And
oh, who would that be?
Well, I used to do it myself.
Yeah.
But, you know, we see the headlines in the news, you know, and people don't realize that oftentimes what's getting triggered there is actually your survival, you know, because cars are very dangerous, and when somebody cuts you off, they really are putting your life at risk.
Yeah, I was amazed that just the configuration of the interchange triggered me. I mean, I had been there before.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strange.
Yeah, and, you know, if you didn't know, if you couldn't remember what had happened there, your body would probably still have a reaction to it.
Right.
So,
and then you look at your partner and you say,
oh,
what did you do to me? Why am I
You know, it's also helpful to note on the calendar, you know, like death, divorce,
yes.
things like that, because that stuff comes up and sometimes you're not paying attention to the calendar and all of a sudden you're feeling blue or, you know, kind of cranky, and however you, you know, react to that memory. It's kind of a muscle memory, so, you know, it's like it's built into your body. They don't ask for our permission for these things, you know.
No.
These
no.
life events, they just kind of embed themselves.
So if we can just segue ahead a little bit.
Absolutely.
You've been teaching a workshop that I've never been able to attend about using your rage, using your anger.
Ah, yes.
So to reconnect, maybe even spice things up.
Right, like what does sex and anger have to do with each other?
Right, so I mean, if you've come through something and come back from your time out and realized, okay, I'm still pissed at you, but if most of this was triggered or whatever, is there something you can do with all of that besides just go hit the couch and try to dissipate your anger or what?
Right. You know, a lot of people, when you say sex and anger, they actually think of something called angry sex, which I found in the Urban Dictionary means that people are, they're not really resolving their issues. They're just taking the issues and channeling it into their sex life with each other. So they're actually pretty pissed off with each other, and then they turn that into what, you know, some people consider good sex. I think it sounds like potentially dangerous sex. I'd rather see somebody do a full-blown BDSM scene, including blood sports and branding, than angry sex, because at least people who do kink are, you know, very experienced and trained, and they do it's safe, sane, and consensual, and, mm-hmm. and thoroughly negotiated. But this angry sex thing, which is actually kind of popular in the media right now, is based upon people just kind of going crazy. It's like, you know, I'm mad at you, you're mad at me, let's have sex. Which sounds to me
no rules, no holds barred.
No.
Well.
No, and it just sounds like an opportunity for somebody to either get physically hurt or more importantly, I think emotionally hurt, where people
yes.
are not really showing up with all their emotions. So I'm not advocating that. Actually,
okay.
I'm trying to help people get in touch with their anger and resentments towards each other, and hopefully learn how to communicate those in a way that's healthy, and then move past them. So I'm looking at anger as a block. So basically, people feel that rage come up. They know they better control it because they don't want to get into trouble, and this creates this tamping down of all their emotions. And also a little bit of an out-of-body experience so that you're not fully embodied and fully connected. And if you do that once or twice, that may or may not have a deleterious effect on your libido or even your ability to laugh. But over time, and this is what you often see with long-term couples, is they haven't really dealt with those feelings. So over time, the sex life dies, and then you see this old couple sitting in the restaurant. It's their wedding anniversary. They're having dinner, but they're there for an hour. They don't look at each other or speak a word to each other the entire time. And
right.
we've all
don't
seen that couple in the restaurant. You know, it's pretty scary.
Yes.
But, you know, and that may be an extreme, but that's kind of what it looks like if you push it out far enough into the future.
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not so extreme that I haven't been there.
Yeah.
Not sure if that's a horrible admission or what here.
Well,
but
it's life.
If you don't know what else to do with your anger, then lash out at the other person. I mean, what else can you do?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. And you don't want to lash out. You don't want to lose your temper. And so you just, you know, it's just like layer upon layer upon layer of repressed emotions.
Yes.
Yeah. And what that does is, I mean, it just affects everything. It affects your orgasms, your laughter, your ability to be, you know, a really passionate, creative, fully alive person. Takes a toll on you in so many ways. And, of course, it's not good for your health either.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, well, there's so many reasons besides the relationship. And a lot of times people will say, oh, it's not worth a fight. And it's like, oh, my God. When I meet a couple that says, oh, we never fight, I'm like, oh, that's so scary. And it's not that I want them to, you know, yell and scream and call each other names. Far from it. I think those sort of things are destructive. But learning how to say, I feel angry when you do this, or I feel sad when you do this, now that is a way to open up dialogue. And a lot of times, it's a way to build compassion. But there's a whole art to this. You have to learn how to speak in I feel statements. If you're in a crisis with your partner and the first word out of your mouth is you, that's usually right there a huge trigger that most people don't have a, you know, they have a negative response to it. They'll feel defensive. And as soon as somebody hears the word you, oftentimes their body tightens, their breath gets a little more constricted, they start breathing shallow breaths and a little more, quickly. It's fight or flight, you know, it activates the part of their brain that's looking for an escape or a good defense. And they can't even hear you anymore. It's like whatever it was you were trying to communicate gets lost because you said the word you, and then they're off and running going, I never did that, or I hardly ever do that, or what, you know. So
whatever you're going to say, it's not true.
Yeah, it's not a good strategy for communicating. So I opens up your partner's heart. Your partner then hears things like, oh, you're sad. And if you can separate that out from what they did and just say, I'm feeling sad, and really give your partner a chance to connect with that, and then say, okay, I'm feeling sad because of something that happened or something that you did, and I would love it if you could change that because it doesn't work for me. See, that's way different than you're bad, you're wrong, you shouldn't have, you always. The minute you tell your partner that they always something, they're going to think of at least that one time they didn't do it.
Yeah.
And it's so much more important to point that out at that point, you know. I remember one time I did not do this.
Right.
So the conversation winds up going off in directions that don't really serve either one of you.
So you say, I am sad. So it sounds like you're building a connection before you even turn to what the issue is.
Sometimes it doesn't even matter to solve the issues, to find a solution. You know, it's nice, it's wonderful, but I consider that like the cherry on top, if you will, when you and your partner can actually come to a point where you'd say, okay, this is how we're going to handle this from here on out. The important part really is caring. It's feeling connected to each other in a way that's compassionate. And that's one thing that's really missing from a lot of couples' relationships is this lack of compassion. And a lot of that starts with the self. People are not having a lot of compassion for themselves. So it's really hard to give away something that you don't have. If you're not compassionate to yourself, it's difficult to be compassionate to anybody else.
That's worth writing down.
All right. I love it. Taking notes. Yeah. Well, it's like love. Love starts with yourself, too. If you don't love yourself, then, you know, what will very quickly happen when you find the part of yourself that you're not loving is that the love that you feel for your partner starts getting expressed in a way that's more about need. Like, I need you. I need you to fill me. I need you to fix me. I need you to make me whole.
Right.
Now, and this is where that dance comes in again. It's been my experience that very healthy, highly evolved people still do this. They still dip down into this place where they're insecure and feeling inadequate and incomplete. and want the other person to say or do something that's going to make them feel okay. And up to a point, I think, you know, it's great if we can be there for each other and assure each other and console each other and nurture each other. But we also have to stand on our own 2 feet.
Yes, it becomes a bottomless, I mean, it's never enough.
Yeah. And once you fall into that little pit, yes, or that big pit.
Yeah, I should unpack that. They can never give you enough to fill your own hole.
No. No, it's just, it's endless.
Yeah.
It's endless. And I'll tell you, I have learned over time, I can kind of, not always, but somewhat, I can sense the difference between those two. When I'm just genuinely hurt about a specific thing that happened, and I need assurances around that specific thing, versus I have fallen into that horrible pit of low self-esteem and despair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I desperately need my partner to put something in there, and it's, you know, it's never going to be enough.
Right. Just
they feel a little bit different. Actually, they feel a lot different, but in the beginning, I think it's kind of hard to tell. One real good clue if you're dealing with low self-esteem, mm-hmm, and your own bottomless pit is if your partner is able to rectify whatever situation was bothering you. In other words, they've met your terms or come up with a great solution in some way. They're showing up for you in a way that makes you feel good at first, mm-hmm, and then very shortly after that, it's like you're finding fault again.
Right.
So if that's where you go, where you're finding fault or picking on them, then that's, you know, oftentimes it's a good indication that you're problem is really about how you're relating to yourself.
Or how they're relating to themselves.
If they're the one that's feeling bad about themselves, yeah. Yeah, it's...
So,
yes.
When you find yourself in that situation, what were... You gave me a list of rules once. I mean, when you find out that it's you, it's the bottomless pit within your heart, and what are the basics of working on that? I mean, you need to fix that, right? You can't keep going back to your partner and saying,
yeah,
fix me.
A lot of this comes under the heading of reparenting yourself. You know, vast majority of us have not had real successful parenting. Our parents did the best they could, but a lot of times they were too young, too something. Maybe they were addicted to substances or had other problems. They might have even been mentally ill, like, you know, my father. But whatever their story is, oftentimes they fall short of being ideal parents, and we are left a lot of times with certain scars and you know, portions of ourselves that are really quite injured and bruised. So reparenting is really about building this relationship with your inner child. The first time I heard about an inner child was years and years ago when I was first starting this road of recovery, and I thought it sounded stupid. I'm like, I'm one person. How could I have an inner child? But they actually have this fabulous exercise that I've done quite a bit, which is writing with the non-dominant hand. And so if you're left-handed, you would write with your right hand, and if you're right-handed, you write with your left hand. And you get out a piece of paper and crayons or pencils or pens, whatever you kind of gravitate towards. Mm-hmm. And with your dominant hand, you write down a question for your inner child, you know, be like, what can I do for you? And then you pick up the same writing instrument with your left hand, or in my case, or if you happen to be left-handed, it'd be your right hand. So whichever hand is non-dominant, you pick up a pen or a crayon with that, and you write out an answer. Now, one time I did this exercise, the answer I got was, I want a birthday party with balloons.
Really?
Yes, and I was really annoyed. The adult me was very annoyed by this inner child's answer. I thought it was stupid.
Truly, yes. Oh, dear.
So, that's that's where you can first start to see the edge of how cold or dismissive or even downright cruel you might be towards yourself.
Yes, you don't deserve balloons. It's stupid. Yeah.
It's, well, it's not expedient or necessary. And we're trying to accomplish things. And it's not even your birthday. So I got to see. Just, you know, that's just why? Why be so cold? What's the harm? I had to ask myself, what is the harm of throwing a party with some balloons? You know, but, I had a very strong reaction against it. So it's a good way to start getting acquainted with what's the unmet needs that you have. And this is often where people's plans to accomplish something run afoul. They might have all the information and resources at their disposal, but they're never actually going to get the task accomplished, whatever that may be, because their inner child is running interference. Their inner child is like not getting their needs met, so they're not actually going to let the adult progress or move forward.
Right.
So that angry inner child really needs your attention. And I recommend, you know, doing the exercise of writing with your non-dominant hand. That's one.
That sounds useful. I mean, I have this thing where I, like, somebody's on strike somewhere here.
Uh-huh. It's exactly right. Somebody is on strike.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how to get past that?
Got to talk to them. Got to talk to the strikers.
Yes, you do.
So.
You got to negotiate. Other things that have come up for me over time, you know, I've taken my inner child out to play. You might get yourself a teddy bear to sleep with at night or a favorite toy that was taken away from you when you were a kid. In my case, I bought myself a doll and a Tonka truck because I experienced some loss around those two toys when I was very young, probably about 6.
Mm-hmm.
So there's ways in which you can start, you know, building a relationship with yourself that is more gentle and nurturing and kind. And then, of course, the other thing is I like to think of this as being like the defender or the champion or the hero for your inner child. So, you know, if your inner child has been, or just, you know, you as a child when you were growing up, if you were abused or hurt, it's really wonderful to come in and make contracts with yourself, asserting that you are going to take excellent care of you and that, you know, maybe your parents weren't there when you needed them, but you're going to be there.
Yes, that is the hero or the rescuer. Because,
yeah,
as a kid, there wasn't anybody else. I mean, who was going to step in? No one.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So, I call them contracts. I make agreements or contracts with myself.
That's hard. Or at least I find that hard.
Yeah? How so?
We're getting a little open here. I never honor them.
Oh, okay, right.
And I guess that's a little counterproductive probably, eh?
Well, of course, that probably reminds your inner child of how they've been treated in the past, I would assume. Somebody else didn't honor them either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know who that might have been. Maybe a parent.
Doesn't matter at this point.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's nice to retrace it, though, is all.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, if I violate those boundaries with myself, then sometimes I actually give myself apologies, you know, again, a lot of times this stuff sounds silly, and people are pretty reticent to actually do it. But it's amazing how many things people will do in their head. It's like, oh, yeah, I get it. And it's like, no, you actually have to do it. You can't just get it. You need to do it. You know, write it down. Attach some ceremony or ritual to it. You know, something that's going to actually stick with you. And
even put it on
go in and have some meaning or depth to it. Mm-hmm. So that's
So, and that will take some of the pressure off your partner.
And the relationship.
Yeah, to provide all that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So boundaries, then, you know, you talked mm-hmm. about boundaries, asked about boundaries. This is also part of taking care of yourself. And whether you envision yourself as a full-grown adult or you envision yourself as this inner child that you're trying to build a rapport with, the boundaries become really important. And that really, you know, kind of brings us full circle to your initial question. How do I keep my boundaries when I'm in love with somebody? Because when you get into a relationship, there is a tendency to surrender boundaries. And I, now, whenever I'm having a persistent behavior that's really messing with me, one of the first things I like to do is I like to go find out where the payoff is. There's usually a payoff. There's a reason I don't want to change it, because I like what I'm getting from it. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. Would you be willing to share an example?
Sure. Let's say that I really want to learn how to let my partner help me. You know, maybe I'm tired of having a one-woman show and I want to make myself available for assistance and more partnership-type activities. One of the payoffs for myself in not allowing others to help me is this feeling that I did it all by myself and I get all the credit. And that if somebody helps me, that somehow or another I won't feel as much of a sense of accomplishment. So there's the payoff. The payoff for choosing to be alone and solitary and isolated and unsupported is that at least whatever I do, I can feel like I did it all by myself.
Self-sufficient.
Yeah. That's way beyond self-sufficient, actually. You know, it's really allowing my ego to run the show to the point where it's inconvenient and maybe even hurtful to myself, because I might, you know, be kind of overextended and and tired. And I might have a long list of reasons why I'd rather have help. maybe I don't know what I'm doing, and my partner can add, you know, some information that would actually be very edifying.
They can.
But if
be
I'm
useful.
Concerned about losing control, or I'm concerned about losing the praise or the credit or whatever, then that becomes, you know, the edge that I have to work against. I have to try to balance those. So I get to ask myself, you know, some questions like, how much is it worth to you to be able to say, I did it all by myself? So that's for me. And for me at this stage in my life, I have done so many things by myself. And there was quite a bit of satisfaction around that, and still is. You know, retrospectively, I can look back and go, oh, I did that by myself, and I did that, you know. But really, if I want to get super honest, you know, none of us actually lives by ourselves. There are always people, circumstances, and situations that are supporting us and helping propel us forward. And, you know, so if I change my perspective, then the idea that my partner could help me move forward becomes a real gift, actually. And and much more meaningful than getting that kind of help from strangers or people that I might pay to help me.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the work takes place where you are shifting your perspective so that you can kind of buy in to the behavior that you're trying to create from yourself. So, and maybe, you know, this is a bit of a stretch here, but we're talking about that inner child, reparenting that inner child. Sometimes I use the same kind of mind games that parents would use on children. I use them on myself to get myself to cooperate and to show up.
Huh. Rewards, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Huh.
So, did you have more questions about this whole idea of how not to slide into giving up your space and to a partner? Because
Well, I'm wondering what the payoff is for me in that.
Ah, yeah.
And, I mean, that may or may not be relevant to anybody in the world but me, but...
Well, you know, one of the things that I have found is true for a lot of people who give up all their boundaries when they are in a loving relationship is that they might feel unworthy of love. And so if they say yes to everything and they're super, super supportive and they don't have any boundaries and they just give and give and give, this is kind of a compensation for feeling like they don't really deserve to be loved. Does that ring true for you at all?
Or just fear that you won't do enough to keep it going.
Yeah, right. If I say no, if I have a boundary, I might lose you. If I say no, I might lose you. That's terrifying, I think, for all of us, frankly.
Yeah, yes. So, you know, I'm still intrigued by your saying that it doesn't even really matter if you work out the issue.
Ah,
as long
yes.
as you have compassion for one another. Maybe that ties in here. If you actually have the compassion for one another, whether or not the specifics get worked out, that gives you assurance that this really is a relationship. This isn't just a convenient socioeconomic partnership or whatever the heck.
Right. It's,
where if you don't keep making your payments, you know, the bank will throw you out or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So, here's the... Oftentimes when I'm working with my clients and they're up against, oh, but if I say that, she or he will leave me, you know?
Yes.
I wouldn't dare ask for that, or I wouldn't dare say no to that because they'll leave me.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe they will.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, if you're living in a place of fear, this is not a real healthy connection anyway. And it might be healthy in many other respects, but once you start to surrender that edge and just decide that I'm going to start saying yes to things that don't really work for me because I don't want to lose this person's love and approval. As soon as you start making those kind of compromises, it's this really slippery slope, and pretty soon there's just not enough things you can compromise about. And at some point, you know, there's going to be diminishing returns, usually pretty quickly. And then, of course, the other thing is that you're kind of stalling the inevitable, because if the relationship is that precarious that you have got to feed it by sacrificing who you are and giving up your no, then in the long run, you're not going to have anything anyway.
Well, that's really true.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can shovel out.
At some point, your partner would get so used to always hearing yes and never hearing a no that they would expect it, and then you introduce one no somewhere in the next 50 years, and you'd find yourself at, you know, the end of the relationship anyway.
Right, crisis, yeah.
And then what have you got? Years and years of saying yes to things you really wanted to say no to. It would actually be better if the relationship is that precarious. It would be better to end it sooner rather than later. So at least you'd be able to walk away with some self-respect and less grief. You know, it's really about the grief, that mountain of grief, about all the no's that were converted into yeses because you were too afraid.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
I'm having a hard time with it.
I think everybody, you know, battles with that one. And as far as creating that connection and that compassion without necessarily being obsessed with whether or not the situation gets solved, we can play that backwards, where a lot of people will try to solve the situation without getting connected and without expressing compassion. And it leaves an empty feeling, usually, where people have, like, agreed, okay, fine, we'll do it this way, and okay, fine, we'll do it that way. But they still all feel good about each other.
Right. Yes. Yeah, I can see that a lot.
Yeah. So somebody got their way, but nobody's really getting fed. Nobody's really feeling connected. Because, that does not create understanding and connection and compassion. So you can take a situation like with my ex-husband where we do not we really have like zero compatibility at this particular time in our lives. But we have a great deal of compassion for each other. And so when we follow the format of the communication techniques that we've learned over the years, and they still work. And so some people would say, well, what do you get out of that? Well, you know, from my perspective, having loving connections with other human beings is really more valuable to me than whether or not we actually live in the same house or have a romantic life or can even agree on politics or whatever. I mean, I'm much more interested in the love, you know, keeping love alive.
So this is amazing to me. So you're saying that you're in this relationship. I mean, you are in this relationship, right?
Yeah.
Like it's gone away with this guy, and nothing at all is working between you except your compassionate connection.
That's it. Exactly. So we don't live in
the same house.
We don't really. Well, we were just talking today, and he says, we have nothing to say to each other, and we just laughed. It's true. We have nothing to say to each other. And we'll no doubt talk tomorrow and have nothing to say to each other again.
And yet the compassion and love is there.
Oh, yeah. The day of our divorce, it was so interesting. You know, we were walking along the beach holding hands and talking about how incompatible we are. And we were able to laugh and joke about it. And we shared some things with each other that each of us had experienced and felt really good about, and it had nothing to do with each other. And we were just feeling joy that the other person had something in their life that was making them happy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I know that's going to extend my life and make me a healthier person and helps me sleep at night and brings joy to my life. So I think this whole focus on wanting to have situations mapped out according to our fantasies as opposed to actually having connections that, feed our souls. I take the latter every time. I'd rather have a connection that feeds my soul.
So it strikes me like this is a model for getting along with all those other people out there that we have, that things don't work with. I mean, you know, those people with different religions,
right,
different whatevers, or, you know, I mean.
Do you want to be my PR guy? And you brought that home just like 60 seconds before I have to get off the air.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. That's perfect. That's absolutely perfect, because peace does begin in the home.
Well, I guess so.
Yeah.
Thank you, Veronica.
About our personal relationships with each other. So it starts with ourselves, right? Then it extends to the people in our immediate circle, and then ideally out into the world. Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you.
So are you going to come to the workshop?
if you hold one within 600 miles, yeah.
I am. I'm going to be up at the Center for Sex Positive Culture I think it's just 2 weeks. Maybe it's three
weeks. Seattle. Okay, yeah. So I haven't seen... All right, I'll have to check the list of...
I will be in Seattle. Yes, and
right.
It's going to be on Saturday the 16th.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I will certainly see you then.
Oh, yeah. You're going to see me one way or the other, even if you don't come to the workshop. Eric, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay. Thank you, Veronica.
Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with me. Sering kesepian, kenapa tak memutuskan berita?